are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
We're going to go way back to the Old Testament. In fact, way back to the life of Abraham. Now, Abraham's life was an adventure of faith. Throughout the New Testament, he is referenced as a man of extraordinary faith in God. Paul points to Abraham as the spiritual father of all believers. He is the Bible figure we look to as the example for how we should trust God today. In fact, by virtue of our faith in Christ, we become Abraham's spiritual descendants. What made his faith so exemplary? Well, the writer of Hebrews highlights for us two key moments in his life that marked him as a man of faith. The first is when God directed him to leave his family home and venture out on his own into Canaan. Now, this would be the promised land for his physical descendants, the nation of Israel. How was this move a decision of faith? Well, according to Hebrews, Abraham had no idea where he was going, but he showed his faith by his obedience. He simply followed God to direct him to the right place. In a pagan land filled with nations that did not know the Lord or his righteous ways, Abraham had no choice but to obey God's leading in this venture. The second decision of faith was to offer up his own son, Isaac, as a sacrifice. The writer of Hebrews refers to the story of Abraham going up the mountain to prepare an altar on which his only son, the son promised by God for 25 years, would be laid. In this test of faith, Abraham proved himself faithful. It took the angel of the Lord to keep him from making the final death stroke on his son. Apparently, he believed that if he went through with this sacrifice, God would be faithful to keep his promise still, so that perhaps he would even bring Isaac back to life from the dead. Now, thankfully, this was never needed, as God provided a ram in Isaac's place. What an incredible example of faith. Any believer who was seeking a closer walk with the Lord would be desirous of such faith. At the same time we marvel at the faithfulness of this man, we must also recognize his flaws and his failings. If you've paid attention to the news, this seems to be a popular trend today. People will identify a revered historical figure with significant flaws that are obvious to today's culture, and then they will destroy his reputation in the eyes of decent society. Now, this trend has one merit in that it forces us to reckon with the reality of the past. The men and women that we look up to as examples of our morals and virtues in today's society were not perfect people. However, I'm not convinced that the people behind this trend today have pure motives or ends. I also think that they fundamentally misunderstand the privilege they have to stand on the shoulders of giants, people who lived out biblical values and morals, albeit imperfectly. Abraham was one such man. Because of his faith in God, the messianic line of Jesus Christ was preserved. And yet he himself had his own moments of weakness, frailty, and even unbelief throughout his journey of faith. Now, I want to focus tonight on two moments in particular that highlight this. Instead of discrediting this hero of faith through these examples, I hope to exalt the goodness and grace of God, as well as provide hope for believers today who desire to live by faith. In the two stories we'll look at tonight, found in Genesis 12, 10 through 20, and Genesis 20, 1 through 18, Abraham made a serious mistake. He failed to tell the truth. As we will see, his deceit was only a cover for the deeper root problem within: unbelief. Like Abraham, we can hide unbelief in many ways, but in the end, it does not pay, and it will never pay. Now, in the first account we're going to look at tonight, in Genesis 12, we find Abraham, or Abram as he's called at this time, he's at an important crossroads in his life as a 75-year-old man. Most of us have lived our lives, we're ready for retirement by the time we're 75. No, Abraham, at 75 years old, was starting a new adventure in his life. God had spoken to him on two important matters. In his sovereign grace, he chose Abraham to be the father of a great nation with innumerable descendants. He made a covenant with him that included a new homeland for him and his prodigy. The only caveat was Abraham must uproot his family and move to this land called Canaan and make it his new home. And he did this with every intention of making it a home. However, there was a severe famine in the land that forced Abraham to head further south toward Egypt. Now, before entering Egypt, he made a request to his wife, Sarah, or Sarai, as she was called at this time. He asked, or you could say even compelled her, to treat him as her brother and not her husband while in a foreign land. He believed that because she was so beautiful, some love-crazed Egyptian might get the idea that if they could kill Abraham, then they would get Sarah. Now, mind you, Sarah was only 10 years younger than Abraham, making her 65 at this time. Now, this is in no offense to elderly ladies at all, but it's difficult for us to imagine that a man would be tempted by a woman of that stage of life. Nevertheless, we do have biblical warrant to believe that Sarah was preserved even at this stage in her life. We read about how Moses in Deuteronomy 34, when he died at the age of 120, that his eyes did not dim. He wasn't going blind, and he did not lose his vigor. Well, Sarah died before Abraham at the age of 127, and that was after she had given birth to Isaac at the age of 90. Now, considering all this, we have good reason to believe that even at 65, Sarah's beauty was captivating enough to make Abraham worrisome. Well, Sarah agreed to this arrangement from her husband. They both entered Egypt, and as soon as they presented themselves in Pharaoh's court, the Egyptian princes absolutely swooned over Sarah. As a result, she was taken into Pharaoh's house without any protest from her husband, mind you. And he was given in return a litter of livestock and servants. Now, for someone in Abraham's position as a wealthy man, no doubt this would have been considered a proper bargain. Today, we would be repulsed by something like this happening, but in Abraham's time, this was normal negotiations. This is what happened in the affairs of state. Well, the Lord saw the moral wrong in this bargain, so he punished the house of Pharaoh with great plagues, Genesis 12 says. What exactly this entailed, we can't be entirely sure, but the Hebrew word that's used here is the same word used to refer to the plague of the death of the firstborn in Egypt during the time of Moses in Exodus 11. Whatever the plague was, it was serious enough to bring great distress to the house of Pharaoh. He soon discovered the truth of Sarah's marriage to Abraham, and he strongly scolded Abraham for his deceit. As a result, Sarah was returned to her husband without her purity being compromised, apparently, and they were then asked to leave Egypt. Now, you would think a married couple that went through such an ordeal together would have learned their lesson. But no, Abraham was a glutton for punishment. We see a similar story reenacted 25 years later when Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 90. The couple is much older, and they're still waiting for the promised son that God would give them. Now, you may remember the events surrounding the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Around this time as well. Abraham, around the time of the destruction of those two cities, was residing near a place called Mamre. You can find that in Genesis 18. The next time we see him, though, he takes his family, again, south, near the Negev Desert, to a place called Gerar, which would have been in the country of the Philistines. Now, it's here that Abraham presented his wife Sarah as his sister once again to the king of Gerar, a man named Abimelech. Now, the name given to this man here literally means the king is my father. And that probably tells us that this phrase, this name Abimelech, is more of a title than it is a name. Nevertheless, that's what he's called. So again, we see a foreign leader in this story taking advantage of Sarah being Abraham's sister and then receiving her into his royal home. As a reminder, Sarah is 90 at this time. She would not have looked like a 90-year-old woman today, that's for sure. But we can imagine she was less desirable than she was at 65. In fact, we don't find any mention in the story that Abimelech took her for her beauty. That's never mentioned. More than likely, marrying her would have been a sign of friendship and trust between a prominent man like Abraham and King Abimelech. In this account, we find a clear difference from the Egyptian episode that we just read in Genesis 12. In here, in this story, God actually speaks with Abimelech and warns him about Sarah. Abimelech apparently had some kind of relationship, some kind of knowledge of Yahweh. We don't know what that looked like, but when God speaks to him in a dream, he responds with humility and with submission. He doesn't question God at all. In the dream, God warned the king, "If you take Sarah, I will kill you." Very serious threat. And the reason he was going to do that was because she was already married to Abraham. Now, Abimelech, in his innocence, repeats what Abraham told him. The man told me she was his sister, not his wife. Well, God acknowledged this and gave him directions for how to right the situation. So in the morning, Abimelech confronted Abraham about his deception, which gave Abraham a chance to explain his reasoning behind what he did. And we're going to look at that a little later in the message tonight. Abimelech restored Sarah to Abraham, then gave him a hefty restitution payment of money, animals, plus the added benefit that Abraham and his family could live anywhere in the land. Now we find at the end of the story that because the king took Sarah for himself, that God actually punished the nation by making the women of the royal court barren, including Abimelech's wife. Now, after Abraham prayed for Abimelech and his household, the women were actually able to give birth again. Their wombs were opened, the Bible says. Now, those are the two stories in summary. Now, let's consider what is similar and what is different about them. The similarities are obvious. Abraham told the same lie about Sarah. Instead of treating her as his wife, he asked her to be his sister while they resided in a foreign country. The foreign leaders who saw Sarah, Pharaoh and Abimelech, took her under the premise that she was indeed Abraham's sister. Both of these leaders and their royal houses were then punished by God for this action. But strangely enough, we don't find God punishing or even confronting Abraham at all. The leaders then quickly discover Abraham's deception, and they return Sarah to him. In both accounts, he was also greatly rewarded by these nations with livestock and servants, and in the case of Gerar, with money. Finally, in neither account do we have any indication that Sarah's reputation as a married woman was compromised or sullied by the foreign leaders. In other words, even though she was taken into their home, her purity was never in question. She never had any physical relationship with anyone outside of Abraham. Now, those are the similarities. Let's notice the significant differences between these two accounts. Obviously, the ages and experiences of the couple have changed. 25 years is a large time gap. In Egypt, the first story, we get an inside peek at the marriage conversations that went on between Abraham and Sarah. Before they entered the country, Abraham made a request to Sarah, and she complied, though we don't know what she said about it. We don't know her thoughts. We don't know if she had any backlash to it. She just apparently complied with what her husband wanted. In Gerar, there's no such conversation that is recorded. Abraham tells us why in Genesis 20 and verse 13. The understanding between these two married people was that when they entered any new territory, Sarah would be considered his sister. Now, the reason that Pharaoh and Abimelech took Sarah also appears to be different. Again, we talked about this already a little, but Pharaoh, we know, took her because she was beautiful, or at least the Egyptian princes thought she was beautiful. In Gerar, that is not the case. We are able to assume that Abimelech probably had political reasons for wanting to marry the sister of someone prominent and wealthy like Abraham. Other differences in these stories highlight the unique situation that took place in Gerar. Again, in Egypt, we're not told about how Pharaoh learns the truth that Sarah is actually married to this guy, Abraham. But the plague that took place on his house was all that he needed to get her back to him. Now, Abimelech had the privilege of direct communication from God, and that's how he found out the truth about Sarah. The consequences in both stories are also fascinating to note. After Abraham is exposed in Egypt, Sarah is returned to him, and then they're both forced to leave the country. So in Egypt, he's not able to stay there. But in Gerar, something totally different happens. When King Abimelech confronts Abraham, he gives him a chance to explain himself. And not only that, but he allows Abraham and the family to stay in the country. Now, finally, in Gerar, we see Abraham interceding for Abimelech's royal house so that the barren women could give birth again. What exactly this means is unclear. It doesn't seem like there was a long time gap between Sarah being taken by Abimelech and then returning her to Abraham. What we do know is that the ability to bear children in a royal house was very important to the life of a king, the life of a leader at this time. And the restoration of this to the royal women would have been a huge benefit to them. That's something they would have desperately wanted. Now, in our modern culture, it's difficult to resonate with these accounts in Abraham's life. If any other character was connected to these stories besides Abraham, we would discount such a person as an immoral scoundrel and then a bad husband to boot. With our modern sensitivities, that would be a perfectly appropriate observation. From Abraham's standpoint, however, what he did could have been culturally justified. Now, it's unfortunate, but treating women like property and using them as means to ends was just normal practice during this time in history. It doesn't make Abraham's behavior moral or excusable, but it does help us as 21st century believers to understand the circumstances and the cultures that our favorite Bible characters faced. Now, speaking to men directly, of course, because Abraham was a husband, a man, we might be tempted to read these stories with high heads, clean hands. We might pride ourselves on the reality that this opportunity that Abraham had to treat his wife this way would never be presented to us. And even if it was, we would never stoop so low to treat our wives or women in general in such a degrading way. Now, there's certainly room here to talk about how the Bible actually upholds the role and the special character and nature of women and how men should actually treat them with love and respect. But the focus of this study is to pinpoint something that both men and women struggle with. As we look at these verses, we find a weakness that every child of God can resonate with, men and women, young and old. And that weakness is unbelief. Now, this may not seem important or apparent at first, but the more we dive into the story, the more obvious this is going to become. Let's go ahead and unpack the conversation that took place between Abraham and Abimelech in Genesis 20. Now remember, in our first story, Pharaoh doesn't give Abraham a chance to explain himself. He just chides him and then lets him go. Says, you got to leave. Well, with Abimelech, there's a friendship that develops between these two individuals. So we can look at their conversation with a more careful eye. And of course, the Bible actually records this conversation for us. Now again, after Abimelech finds out about Abraham's deception, he feels betrayed. I mean, after all, had he treated Sarah as his wife, had he done anything to her, God would have ended his life. God would have struck him down immediately. So the king confronts Abraham with a litany of questions. What have you done? What did I do to offend you that you would put this great sin on me and on my people? What were you thinking? Those are essentially his questions to Abraham. Now, before we get to his immediate answer, I want you to notice that Abraham admits in verse 12 that Sarah was his half-sister. They had the same father, but not the same mother. Now, again, like many odd practices that we've encountered already, this would not have been something out of the ordinary in Abraham's day. What we do know is that their marriage was one that God ordained, something that he put together, and one that he used to bring about his purposes. Now, the question then that remains is this. Did Abraham even lie? If Sarah was his half-sister, was he really lying? Well, from both stories, it seems obvious that he did. In fact, it seems that Abraham did not think that he deceived these foreign leaders because he was telling at least a half-truth. But I think we're well aware that a half-truth is a whole lie. To misrepresent or twist the truth to our own ends is wrong, no matter how much of the truth is left over. Lying is forbidden by the Ten Commandments, bearing false witness. And the book of Proverbs calls it an abomination, lying lips. God's hatred for lying is reiterated in the Old Testament. I'm sorry, in the New Testament. In his sight, to conceal the truth from people who need to know is morally repugnant. As Christians, we must not fall into the trap of bending the truth for our own purposes. Let us be a people who always present the truth. Now, deception was no doubt one of Abraham's chief flaws in this story, but it's not the only one. There's also a question of how he treated his wife. Now, some husbands might actually sympathize with Abraham's conundrum. He's entering a new territory. It's unknown. He doesn't know the dangers that could confront him or his family. And he wanted to protect his wife from prying eyes. So he asked her, just be my sister while we're here in a new place. Now, of course, we know this strategy didn't even work for either situation. In fact, his deception put her in greater danger. But can we assume that Abraham's motives were entirely pure, that he just wanted to defend his wife, that's all he cared about? Well, the evidence from Genesis 20 says otherwise. When Abimelech asked Abraham, why did you lie to me? Why did you not tell me the truth? Abraham comes right out and tells him the reason why in verse 11. Because I thought, surely, the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. You know, Abraham could have said, Abimelech, all I wanted to do was protect my wife from you pagan people. That's all I wanted. But he didn't say that. He knew that excuse was bogus. His reason for telling the lie was simple: self-preservation. He only cared about himself and protecting his own life from harm. Now, in some way, I'm sure he probably thought that this arrangement would actually protect Sarah, but his chief concern was really for himself. Do you recognize Abraham's reasoning from anywhere else? Go back to Genesis 12, and you'll find in the first account that when Abraham and Sarah were in Egypt, he told his wife to act like his sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Genesis 12, verse 13. Abraham wasn't hiding his motives. He was so bold as to tell his wife he was making this odd request so that he would be safe. Now, at her husband's behest, Sarah complied, but only for the sake of Abraham's safety. We see further evidence that his motives were not entirely pure when we look at what Abraham got in exchange for giving Sarah up. When Pharaoh, in the first story, took her into his house, Pharaoh realized, this isn't a free gift. I'm not getting a wife for my princes, my sons, for nothing here. He offered Abraham sheep, oxen, donkeys, camels, and male and female servants in return. And when Abraham is later exposed and forced to leave the country, he doesn't give up any of these lavish gifts. He keeps them. So did sin pay for Abraham? Well, in a way, yeah, it did. He received valuable material possessions, but at what cost? The cost of almost losing his wife. And the cost of almost losing the possibility of having a child with her that would fulfill God's promise to him of becoming a great nation. The evidence against Abraham in these two instances is just haunting. We should look at the actions he took with shock and disdain, but you know, we also must examine these stories with humble self-evaluation. Beneath the deception of Abraham lies a deeper problem. What is it that drove this man to treat his wife and other people in such abhorrent ways? The common factor is unbelief. He did not trust God to protect him or his family. When entering new territory, he should have trusted in Yahweh to preserve his life and the well-being of his family and possessions. He didn't have to resort to deception. His unbelief gave him the excuse to lie, which led to serious consequences, including his wife being put in jeopardy and foreign nations being punished for his actions. Oddly enough, we never see God directly punishing or confronting Abraham for his deception. We can only assume that the shame of being scolded by a pagan, godless king and the horror of almost losing his wife was punishment enough. We must also consider the long-term consequences of Abraham's unbelief. You may recall that after giving up Sarah to Pharaoh, Abraham was richly rewarded with livestock and servants, both male and female, the Bible specifies. Not too long after Genesis 12, we find Abraham considering being a father to a child with a woman named Hagar in Genesis 16. What was so special about Hagar? She was one of his servants, and she was Egyptian. It turned out that one of his spoils from Egypt became his greatest downfall as a man of faith. For it was with Hagar that he gave birth to Ishmael. So instead of waiting on God to fulfill his promise, he took matters into his own hands. His unbelief in Egypt resulted in more unbelief and failing to trust God to preserve his family line. Finally, there's one more consequence we don't see until many years later. After Abraham has given birth to Isaac after Isaac has been married, after Abraham has died, Isaac, as an adult, as a man, moved his family to Gerar because of a famine. In Genesis 26, what we find is that the apple does not fall far from the tree. When the men of Gerar inquired about his wife, Isaac told the same lie that his father told, that his wife, Rebekah, was his sister. He even gives the same reasoning as Abraham. He was sure the people would kill him in order to take his wife. So Abraham's sin of unbelief became a recurring sinful habit for him, and then it became a family problem. Isaac was not even alive when Abraham went to Egypt or to Gerar, but he showed the same tendency toward unbelief. Friends, Abraham's life was indeed one of faith, but even he had his moments of weakness. We've looked extensively at two examples of this. In both examples, we find a man just trying to protect himself and his family, but without faith in God. Indeed, how many Christians have been caught in the same trap? We think that we're doing right. We think that our actions are justified. But our motives and our actions betray us. Unbelief is a deadly sin with dreadful consequences. We're good at hiding our lack of faith with other sins. Like Abraham, we can misrepresent the truth so that we save our own skin. We can excuse bad behavior to justify positive results. The bad news for us is that God sees right through our pragmatism and our unbelief. He's not fooled or mocked because he knows that whatever we sow, we will eventually reap, whether it's in this life or whether it's in the life to come, whether we see the results, the fruit of what we sown, or we don't. Still, from these accounts, we can salvage important lessons that Christians must take to heart. In the life of faith, challenges come our way that demand a response. How do we respond when our faith gets tested this way? Well, let me propose three truths from this story that I think will benefit us as we seek to live lives of faith rather than unbelief. The first is this: do not lie by misconstruing the truth or presenting an alternate reality. This was the surface problem we come across in Genesis 12 and 20. Abraham lied in order to save his own skin. Now, there's a time and a place to conceal the truth from those who don't need to know about it. Scripture actually gives us examples of this in the Hebrew midwives in Exodus 1, in Rahab in Joshua 2. Abraham, however, does not fit this category. He only told these lies because he did not trust God to preserve him or his family. Have you ever made decisions with your money or your resources because you didn't trust God to provide for you? Have you ever been tempted to withhold something from God because you were afraid that he wouldn't come through for you? These are the subtle ways we manifest our unbelief. But we must resist these urges and trust God with our time, our talents, our abilities. He's given us all these things, so we must let him use them as he wishes, not as we wish. The second lesson we can learn is we must beware of quote-unquote small sins that can reappear in our lives. Lying to a foreign dignitary doesn't seem like a small sin to me. It probably doesn't to you either. If you lied to the President of the United States or to the Congress of the United States under oath, that'd be a serious charge. But it was a fleshly tendency in Abraham's life that he never dealt with. Unbelief may not seem like a small sin either, not trusting God, yet it came back to bite Abraham where it hurt most. We're so quick to categorize sins as large and small, but we must beware that even the smallest sins can become strongholds in our lives. They can anchor themselves into our hearts to the point that they become difficult to resist. as an example, a small problem with watching a TV show or a movie that you know bothers your conscience can become a hardcore pornography addiction in no time at all. I'm not saying that these things will automatically or definitely happen, but we must realize the slippery slope is there, and it's all too easy to entertain it. Abraham experienced an avalanche of consequences, both in the short term and the long term. He put his wife and her reputation in jeopardy. He almost lost the chance to see God fulfill his promise to give him a son in his old age. And even his son, as an adult, was not free from his father's mistakes. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. Finally, the last lesson we can learn from this story that we will focus on tonight is that we must let God control the means by which his plans are fulfilled in our lives. We already know that Abraham had a problem trying to do God's will in his own way, in his own time. He did this with Hagar and Ishmael, trying to be a father outside of God's provision. He wanted Ishmael to be the son of promise, but God wouldn't have it. In the stories we've looked at tonight, Abraham tried to protect his family by deceiving foreign leaders. Not only did he fail to protect Sarah, but he failed to keep God's central promise to him in view. Think about it. God had promised him a child through Sarah, from which a whole nation would be born. But if Sarah was married to a pagan king, how would God keep that promise? How would he ensure that he got the credit for doing the miracle of giving birth to a child through Abraham and through Sarah? Elderly people who physically were not able to bear children. It was God who preserved the integrity of Abraham's line. As a husband, Abraham failed to do this because of unbelief. His fear of being killed supplanted his responsibility to safeguard his family. At the end of the day, we must not excuse bad means with good ends. We think we know how to steer the ship of our life, but friends, God knows how to absolutely capsize us so that we realize he's in control. So friends, let him be in control. Now, there are other lessons that we could draw from this story, but the three we've looked at tonight represent critical truths from these accounts in Abraham's life of his failure to believe God. This doesn't mean we cast him out as a man of faith. We've looked at tonight already, Paul and the writer of Hebrews uphold Abraham as the premier example of trusting in God. So what does this mean for us? Well, it means this. No person, no matter how spiritual, is perfect. It means even the most faithful among us can make poor decisions. It means we must always take heed, lest we fall. It means we must always check our faith and its object. Are you making decisions in life because you trust God or because you fear man? That's a good question to ask yourself the next time your faith gets tested. We hide unbelief in many ways, but in the end, it never pays. Let's remember that as we finish this week. Trust in your faithful God to provide for you and your loved ones. And don't make choices out of fear. Learn to trust in the Lord. Let's close in prayer tonight.